It was, what was it, that game last night? It was a great game. It was a sad loss, but beast mode was back. It was a real mixed bag, wasn't it? The Seahawks came up shorts for Sunday Night Football last night. But the good news is we are still in the playoffs. Here's a highlight of the game.
Love, real straight up. 12, they've made your boy feel right at home.
With Lynch in the backfield, Moore in motion from left to right. The turn, they hand to Lynch. Lynch bounces up into the line of scrimmage, gets a push across the 40, out to about the 43, 44-yard line. A nice push, and Marshawn Lynch showing a little bit of pop, running the football and getting in behind the big guys for a 5-yard gain.
Well, as we have kind of grown to understand about our team, we ain't ever out. And didn't play well in the first half and just couldn't get going at all. And we really felt fortunate to be 13-0. And then our guys just did what they do and found a way to get back and get rolling. And we didn't dominate the second half, but we certainly put ourselves in position to win a championship right there.
Hand off again to Lynch. This time left side breaks it through the middle. Down to the 30. Down to the 27-yard line. Beast mode explodes right upfield. A big first down run on 2nd and 2. And Marshawn Lynch just runs right past everybody for 15 yards and a first down.
You don't all know Marshawn, but you should all be really proud of the way he handled this. He handled it in extraordinary fashion. He has been all in every aspect, everything that he could have done to get ready and to try to help this team. It could have gone a number of different ways. It's such a unique, crazy situation that we put him in, but he handled it impeccably.
Clock is ticking down. Russell gets the snap just before it ticks away. Russell steps up in the pocket. Looks. Still looking. Now he fires. Ball is caught. Touchdown! Seahawks! Tyler Lockett uncovers at the last possible second, and Russell drills it in the back of the end zone from 14 out, and the Hawks are on the board.
That was an amazing game. I mean, I think just the back and forth, offensive, defensively. Both teams, great teams going after it.
Two tight ends, hand off to Mostert, goes right side, knifes back inside, he's in. Touchdown 49ers. From 2 yards out, San Francisco answers back on the Seahawks touchdown with one of their own. The big play, of course, that 49-yarder to the fullback Juszczyk down the far sideline. It's 19-7 now, the Niners leading.
I think we just settled down. I started to feel some legs come up underneath me, but, you know, for the most part, I think just overall the whole situation, you know, everybody settled down.
Two tight ends, single wide out is Lockett. Marshawn in the backfield. Marshawn goes up over the top. He's in. Touchdown, Seahawks. Beast mode does it again. Welcome home, number 24. From 1 yard out, it's like old home week, and Skittles come flying out of the stands at CenturyLink. And just imagine what Marshawn Lynch must be feeling like right now, getting a chance to come back and play for a team that he led to the Super Bowl. And now to score, it's 19-13, the Niners.
Coach Salah, you know, he knows what he's doing over there. He changed up a lot of different things, a lot of different looks and everything else. I thought we handled it really well. I thought the line did a great job with it. The receivers did a great job. And, you know, I don't really have much more to say than just it was a great game. Unfortunately, we didn't come on the end that we thought we were. But, I mean, it was as good as the game as it gets.
The Niners have blitzed almost every play in this drive. Let's see if they do it again. Manning up. Blitz is coming. Russell scrambles right. Looks, throws. Ball is caught. First down inside the 1 yard line. Are you kidding? John Ursua gets the ball back inside. Inside the 1, an 11 yard gain. Russell from the shotgun. Keep your eye on Hollister in the flat. The throw inside. Hollister makes the catch. Did he break the plane? The ball came out. But the clock is ticking down. Nobody can stop it, and the 49ers are going to win at the goal line. Unless Hollister broke the plane.
After review, completed pass receiver was down short of the goal line.
We already have to go and get rolling. Looking ahead, we play Sunday in Philly, and we got to go get that in order and get working in that direction. I mean, how could you not be proud of the way these guys played? How could you not? It was fantastic to put us in position to win that football game after all of that. But it was no surprise either. You know, it was just this was the way we were going to win a division championship, and a couple things happened, didn't quite work out. So we got to move on. Got to go.
Well, it was just a game of football, to be honest with you.
And so to the playoffs we go. Great to hear from Beast Mode there. Also great to see him punching that touchdown from so close. It was like a replay of the Super Bowl that shall not be named.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here's Michael Medved, not to review a movie, but his latest book, which is what, number 5?
It's actually number 14.
Number 14.
Yes, thank you.
So I only counted 5 on Amazon.
Right, right, because that would be 5 that are in current release.
You go.
I have books that go back. My first book was 1976, before you were born.
That's not true.
I know. But I'm trying to be gracious. No.
Well, Hollywood versus America is the first one I remember. That was 92, right?
Correct. Yeah. No. And I Hollywood versus America, I'd done 7 or 8 books before that.
Okay. So this one's called God's Hand on America. And just to give people a flavor of it, you tell a series of stories where you feel there's been divine intervention in American history.
Intervention might be too strong a word. I mean, intervention is what you use when you talk about Russia participating in presidential okay. campaigns. But where people who participated in great events in the United States and great leaders, including leaders, by the way, who were religious skeptics, who were not devout Christians or any kind of devout believer, were those people perceive that there is something here that involves fate, that involves destiny, that involves what we used to call providence, that has allowed the United States to survive and prosper and move in the right direction.
So let's choose one story, which
sure.
was the speech in the pocket that saved Theodore Roosevelt from an assassination attempt.
In October 1912, that Theodore Roosevelt is running for president as a progressive. He's the candidate of the Progressive Party. He's left the Republican Party. This is, in many ways, the most interesting election in all American history. It's the only election where a third-party candidate actually was the runner-up, and that was mm-hmm. Theodore Roosevelt. At the very tail end of this campaign, he was shot in Milwaukee coming out of a dinner on his way to the stadium, Milwaukee Stadium, where he was going to give this big address that was going to reboot his campaign and supposed to set the tone for the last month of his presidential contest. And he was shot from a distance of about 10 feet, and the bullet went into his chest. And he had prepared a very long speech. It was a 50-page speech typed out. And he had it folded over twice and in his coat pocket right in front of his metal glasses case. The bullet went through the speech. The speech has been preserved. You can see mm-hmm. the bullet holes. It went through his speech and through his glasses case and into his chest. And he's bleeding profusely. And he's Theodore Roosevelt, right?
So he goes on.
Yeah. The show must go on, despite pleas from his aides and doctors. He's bleeding up in front, and he says, you may not realize, but I have just been shot. But it takes more than a single bullet to kill a bull moose.
That's right.
And he proceeds with a speech. In any event, the chapter on Theodore Roosevelt is all about his duel with death, which began even when he was a small child.
Well, he's considered a sickly child, and so he overcompensated.
Well, correct, but it also goes to the story of his most famous moment, his crowded hour, charging up San Juan Hill, which was actually Kettle Hill, and being the only member of the Rough Riders who was actually on horseback, and people falling all around him and him escaping bullets. It's the same kind of thing, by the way, that they report about George Washington.
The title of the book is God's Hand in America. So you think that these incidents are examples of divine intervention?
Well, I think this. You can, of course, write out the 10 incidents in the book as happy accidents.
Yes.
But my argument is a pattern of happy accidents is still a pattern. The point that I am making is not that everybody has to look at this and say that, oh, well, America is a favored country or the best country in the world, or we are exceptional and we're great and every other country is stinking. But it does suggest, and what's amazing is how many people came to this conclusion, including Churchill, including Franklin Roosevelt, including John Kennedy, and many others, that America has been chosen by fate or patterns of history as a vehicle for human improvement.
Why do you come to that conclusion, seeing that probably every other country, looking into its own history, and certainly leaders have done this, see some sort of, this is how leaders have established authority from time immemorial.
Correct.
They have claimed some connection to an almighty force.
Correct. And very often that it's a leader who is trying to do that for his own aggrandizement.
Yeah. But here's the thing. If God's hand is really there, why is God always so coy? Why does there happen to be a speech in Roosevelt's pocket? Why does the car just happen to miss a vital organ? Why doesn't God just ride up in the sky, "This is America. It is my chosen nation. Believe him," like the voice that came down as Christ was baptized.
Because, again, the chosen nation idea, and this very much goes back to the old biblical idea of Jewish people as the chosen people, is not so much chosen for special favor, but chosen for special responsibility. Mm-hmm. And part of the test is whether you will willingly seize that responsibility. The point about America, and I cite Professor Walter McDougall of University of Pennsylvania, who says, and I don't think there's any argument with this, that if you look over the last 500 years of human history, the most significant development, without anything else close, is the emergence of the United States of America. It's changed the whole world. And there's an utterly beautiful piece of writing that I had never known before by George Kennan in 1946, his famous Long Telegram, which basically defined the struggle against the evil empire of Stalinism at the time. And he talks about the idea of a test of national character. And that really is the notion of trying to find God's hand on America, not for special privilege, not for special power, but for special responsibility. My last chapter in the book is about Dr. King, who very much believed in this idea of America being specially designated for its ability and its potential in changing the whole world. And I think that our nation has always lived up to it. I hope in our current period of turmoil and polarization, we'll be able to live up to it again.
Michael Medved, the author of God's Hand on America. I would ask you to award your book stars, but that would be a conflict of interest, so I won't.
Actually, looking back on a whole bunch of books, this is one that I particularly like. I was just reading it again, and I think what people will find in it is aspects of historical stories that will surprise them, maybe even amaze them. And the shocking thing is it's all true and very well documented.
Thank you, Michael.
You bet, Dave. Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. What is the world made of, and is there only one of them? Let's go to physicist Sean Carroll, who is at the California Institute of Technology, which is where you have the job that Richard Feynman used to have, right?
Well, the job is a bit of an exaggeration. He was a rather more influential physicist than I can hope to be, but I do have his old desk, which I think is kind of special.
Well, that's pretty close.
Yeah.
Okay, your latest book is called Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. And that's the most controversial thing about this wave theory, is that it depends on there being many simultaneously coexisting worlds. So could you just explain that to us?
Yeah, I mean, the good news is it's kind of the other way around. It's not that you invent a lot of worlds to explain all of these waves. It's that the waves are there. That's what we need to explain the stability of matter and other successes of quantum mechanics. But there's a mystery, which is when you look at the electron, if you look at it very, very closely, it doesn't look like a wave. It looks like a particle. It looks like it has some location in space. So the traditional thing to do in quantum mechanics was to say, there's a set of rules that wave functions obey when you're not looking at them. And it's a very simple, straightforward set of rules. There's an equation that was written down and so forth. But then there's a whole nother set of rules that you need to invoke when you do measure properties of an electron or something like that. And this has never been very satisfactory. Like, what do you mean by measure? Who counts as measuring and things like that? So Hugh Everett came along. He was a graduate student in the 1950s, and he said, if you have a wave that represents all the possible places you could measure the electron, what really happens is when you measure the electron, all of those become real. But what you're forgetting is that you also are a wave function, and you evolve into a superposition of, I observe the electron here, I observe the electron there, and all the different possible outcomes. And they're all real, just in separate, non-interacting worlds.
But why that happens is because these things you're trying to measure are a wave, but you, as the measurer and your equipment, that also represents a wave, and so the wave has to interact with the wave for the measurement to take place, and that is going to affect both waves, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the two waves interact with each other, and that leads to what we call entanglement. So the state of you and the state of the electron become related to each other so that there's a consistent picture where if the electron was seen to be here, you think you saw it at that place and so forth. But all of the parts of the wave now represent different copies of the universe where that outcome of the measurement is slightly different in every one.
And does that mean that there are different copies of us just cruising along parallel to us but beyond our perception?
It does. That's exactly what it means. In fact, in your body right now, thousands of times per second, there are nuclei of atoms that are radioactively decaying. And every time that either happens or doesn't, the universe branches into different possibilities. And so there are many, many, many copies of you being produced all the time.
But where are these copies?
Well, they're not located anywhere in space because, you know, space is located in them. I think the best way to think about it is, all the worlds simultaneously exist, and they all come from a common starting point, but there's no relationship up between them in terms of one is next to each other or anything like that. The way that Hugh Everett put it is, it's kind of like an amoeba branching, right? An amoeba divides in two, and both of the child amoebas have the same memories and past records as the parent amoeba, but now there's two of them where there used to be one. All of the copies of yourself have consciousness. They're all just people, just like you. You just happen to be one of them that is located in the world that you see around you. But everyone is equally real. We just can't ever talk to them and compare notes.
All this branching that's going on, it strikes me where you're creating now pretty much an infinite number of organisms. And this is happening with every passing zeptosecond, right? So does the universe have room for all of these people?
It does. I mean, that's a good question, but I talk about that in the book. The space of all possible universes could be infinitely big. We're not really sure. But if it's infinitely big, then it obviously has room for whatever you want. Even if it's finite, it's still really, 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 really big. There's no worry that we're going to run out of room for new universes, at least not anytime soon.
Sean Carroll, theoretical physicist at Caltech and the author of Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. Sean, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Seattle's Morning News, this is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. What happens when you're counting sheep and counting antelope and it just doesn't work? Could it be screen time? Could it be something else? Let's talk insomnia with the doctor. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD, is it true that insomnia seems to be spreading?
Yeah, Dave, it is spreading, and it's a great question. Actually, you touched on it in your introduction there, and a lot of it has to do with screen time. We're actually starting to understand that exposure to light that's coming off of our screens, whether it's our phones, whether it's our laptops or computers, or whether it's off the television, is actually emitting light in certain wavelengths that when it hits our retina is interfering with our body's ability to produce melatonin in the proper levels, and it actually delays our sleep time. Our body is being tricked into thinking that we're still in daytime mm-hmm. because this light is coming off and hitting our retina and producing. Mm-hmm.
So if you are suffering from insomnia, how do you know whether it's due to the screen time or due to something else?
Well, look, I mean, insomnia can have many different causes. And it's a sleep disorder that regularly affects actually millions of people worldwide. And individuals who have insomnia, actually, their biggest problem is they find it difficult to fall asleep. Or in some cases, they actually find it difficult to stay asleep. But those can be other problems as well. The side effects of insomnia are problematic because people often have daytime sleepiness, or they feel tired the next day, or they actually just don't feel well mentally, physically, or whatever. And oftentimes, they have mood swings or irritability associated with it. We're now starting to understand that insomnia is associated with a higher risk of developing certain diseases. It's actually has other impacts on our health as well. So there's an organization called the National Sleep Foundation. They state that 30 to 40% of American adults report that they have had symptoms of insomnia within the last 12 months, and 10 to 15% of adults claim to have chronic insomnia. So it's actually not an insignificant problem.
So what do you do to treat it without, you know, short of going to the doctor? One thing I found works for me is if you do a lot of yard work during the day, or just, you know, a hike or a physical workout, I got no problem falling asleep.
Well, I think if you have insomnia, you have to understand the cause of it. It's like anything else in medicine is you can have the symptom. The symptom is insomnia, but what's the actual cause? That's the diagnosis that we treat. And the thing is, there's many possible causes of insomnia. So sometimes, like insomnia, can be due to a secondary cause. It can be such as a problem with an illness or lifestyle. Other causes of insomnia can include psychological factors or medications, or actually if your hormone levels aren't right. You have to kind of break it down and see what the possible causes are. Things like jet lag, we all know we experience that when we travel, or if we work a night shift or an evening shift or whatever, things that actually interfere with our ability to sleep on a regular schedule. Actually, changes in altitude. If you go to high altitude, you may not sleep as well until you acclimate to it. Our environment, whether it's, you know, warm out, noisy out, or whatever. So there can be things that disrupt our circadian rhythm. But then you can also have psychological issues. If you have depression, or some people have bipolar disease, or if you have anxiety, those things will obviously interfere with your sleep. And then there's the medical condition. So if you have chronic pain, obviously if you're having pain, it's difficult to fall asleep, or chronic fatigue syndrome. If you have heart conditions, heart failure or angina, some people have acid reflux, and that can interfere with your sleep. And there's a whole host of other things. In women, problems with their hormones fluctuation, so specifically estrogen and progesterone and hormone shifts associated with aging or the menstrual cycle, those can interfere with a woman's ability to sleep. And then there's other things, you know, that we're all aware of, like the noisy partner who snores.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Or the restless sleeping partner or whatever. So, you know, there's all these kind of things. And I think that when somebody has insomnia, they have to, like, really go through what it is in their life and see what it is that's causing it.
So at what point do you decide, I got to go to a doctor for this?
Well, if you're experiencing symptoms and you cannot pinpoint it yourself, and it is not something that you can fix on your own, then I think that it's time to see a doctor and talk to your doctor about it and potentially get referred. And there's a whole area of sleep medicine where there's, you know, people who are specifically trained to look at how you sleep, the quality of your sleep, and any associated sleep disorders. And there's a lot of potential treatments, some of which are medications, some of which are other types of sleep aids. For example, if you have sleep apnea, you may need to sleep with a machine that puts continuous positive pressure into your airway so that your airway doesn't collapse.
What do you think about those white noise machines? The ones that can play either sort of a pink noise, you know, hissing kind of noise, or raindrops or thunderstorms?
Yeah, those actually are very, very useful. Actually, I myself, I don't use an actual white noise machine, but I actually like white noise. And so I run a fan in the bedroom at night because I like the sound of the white noise, and I like the air movement in the room. And it doesn't matter whether it's warm or hot. It's just the noise and some air circulation. So, yeah, things like that that can actually help you be more comfortable in your environment, highly recommended and easy to use. And they're already oftentimes present in your home. And in fact, there's apps that you can get for your phone that actually will produce white noise and help you sleep through the night. So those things actually work quite well.
Just keep the screen off.
Just keep the screen off.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm going to have to start doing that. Don't take the phone to bed with me. But what if we use it for white noise and for the alarm? It's just, it's hard. Our phones have become such a part of our lives. This is Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. Dave is off this week. Aaron Granillo handling the newscast for you today. Dave spoke with Stephanie Kreider from Ohio Right to Life organization about absolute abortion bans that have been proposed in various parts of the country. Here's part of their conversation.
A number of states have toughened up their abortion laws. Alabama is the toughest, but there are new laws in Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, Arkansas, Utah, and Ohio, which is where Stephanie Ronade Kreider is executive director of Ohio Right to Life. And Stephanie, I wanted to ask you, not so much about the Ohio bill, but about the Alabama bill, which has claimed most of the attention because it appears to be an absolute ban, even in cases of rape and incest. Where do you stand on that?
Well, David, I think that we certainly respect the right of Alabama to do what they see fit for their state. You know, they have a pro-life woman who sponsored the legislation, a pro-life female governor who signed it into law. I have a lot of respect for what they're doing in Alabama.
Is it fair to say that the reason for this spate of bills is because the court now has a conservative majority and there is, in fact, a good chance that it might go along with some of these?
Yeah, absolutely. So at Ohio Right to Life, just to give you some context for the landscape in Ohio, we did not support the heartbeat bill the last three times that the legislation was introduced. And our reasoning for that was we really had no reason to believe that the court would be friendly to our cause. Now with the appointment of two pro-life justices, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, we believe that we do have more likelihood. And it's hard to say, but, you know, the president may get another Supreme Court appointment before something like the heartbeat bill even makes it to their docket. And so I think it's a really promising time for us as pro-life people, and we really are trying to capitalize on the timing of that.
Okay, so if you reach your goal and the federal government gets out of the way, Roe v. Wade is overturned and states can pass whatever they want. As far as you're concerned, in Ohio, what would a woman's choices be at that point?
Sure. So our hope is, you know, once Roe v. Wade is overturned, that in Ohio, at the very least, we'd have the standard of the heartbeat being the moment at which abortion is banned. But we would prefer to really make it from the moment of conception and ban all abortion, except in the case to save the life of a mother.
Okay, so ideally, you'd like to see the Alabama bill then.
Yeah. I guess I should clarify that. I think that is the ultimate goal of the pro-life movement on the whole. I think that we just have had to be more strategic. You know, we can't really just propose an abortion ban and expect it to go into effect anytime soon because we don't know where the United States Supreme Court is going to land on something like that.
Well, basically, there's no choice. It's pretty much forced birth once you have a successful conception.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wouldn't use the term forced birth. I think people have choices leading up to a
situation. Well, what would the choice be?
Well, I'm saying they have choices leading up to the situation before they become pregnant. But for Ohio Right to Life,
right. The state requires you to give birth upon a successful conception.
I suppose so. I don't. You know, it's hard to put it.
Well, I mean, you either do or you don't. I mean, we might as well just be frank about it. The state required that the ultimate purpose of the Alabama law is that you are required to give birth, whether it's rape or incest, upon successful conception. The state requires that you go through with the birth.
I think that my personal view is that my hope is every woman would find abortion unthinkable, not just something that's illegal.
But you can't use the language of I would hope. This is because you're talking about laws now. Yes, we would all hope that every pregnancy is successful. I certainly hope that. But we're not talking about hope anymore. Once these bills are passed, it is a government requirement which can be enforced by the courts and I assume ultimately by the police that a woman gives birth. Because I think people have a right to know what the environment would be once Roe v. Wade is overturned and we have Alabama-style bills. It is the state requiring a woman to give birth.
Yeah, I think it's the state requiring that a woman is not able to get an abortion. So, you know, assuming she has
that means giving birth, unless it's a spontaneous miscarriage.
Yeah, exactly. In Ohio, we have never passed a law that criminalizes a woman who has had or is seeking an abortion. The criminal penalties are always assigned to the doctor or, you know, in the case where I know that there are ways that women also are able to get the abortion pill that I referred to before via mail or the internet or something like that. In that case, they would criminalize whoever has provided that drug to her.
I see. So you'd basically have to go to a state that allows that drug to get it. Now, if a woman just went out of state, got the drug, came back, then she would not be prosecuted.
I believe that is correct. I don't think that we would be able to, in Ohio, prosecute someone for having had an abortion in, say, Pennsylvania.
So then this law really applies only to women who can't afford to travel.
That's a good question. I would say no. I think that it applies equally to every woman who becomes pregnant. But, you know, ultimately, our goal isn't just to pass a law that bans abortion. Our goal is to also change hearts and minds along the way so that, like I said, abortion is almost unthinkable. A woman would feel like she had every support she needed or could access every support she needed to either become a mother or, you know, adopt her baby to a family who is ready and willing to take that baby.
So let's talk about what that would look like then. Many times, it's true, people have an abortion because they'll say, I'm not ready for the baby and we can't afford it. So you'd pretty much, I mean, to be true to what you say, you would pretty much have to say, if you have this baby, we will guarantee that you can support it, whether you are married, whether you are single, whether you are homeless. I mean, suppose a homeless woman has a married woman has a baby and goes through with this because under the law she must. You're not going to let them live in a tent, are you?
Right. I mean, I think it's a travesty that right now there are women in that position.
Absolutely.
In probably every city across the country, right? So we support any policy that is going to lift that woman out of poverty here in Ohio.
So whatever it costs then.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that down the line, we'll have to see, you know, what that looks like. So affordable housing is a key issue, at least here in Columbus, Ohio, it is. I think there are things like the Title 20 program, which is federal funding for childcare, is ripe for revisiting. I think the income level to qualify for that is something like $23,000 a year for a woman with one child. I mean, you can't tell me that someone who makes $26,000 a year can suddenly afford daycare for her child.
No,
they can't.
That's right.
Right? I think that for us, we're saying, you know, 2 to 3 years out is when we believe the heartbeat bill will make it to the docket of the United States Supreme Court. That's just reality. The courts take a long time. We can't speed up the legal system. But that gives us 2 to 3 years to start having those conversations right now.
And don't you think, though, that there should be some kind of trigger such that once Roe v. Wade is overturned and your Alabama-style law goes into effect, that it would then automatically trigger the funding to make sure that these babies do not grow up in poverty?
Yeah, I think that's something that we should talk about. We don't have that trigger in our law now. I think it's something we would like to see enacted.
But wouldn't it be, I mean, your heart's in the right place. You're saying talking about it, but these things tend to fall through the cracks when we start talking about funding. And this is going to be incredibly expensive. Would it be right for the abortion prohibition to go into effect without the funding for those children all ready to go?
No, I don't think it would be right. And so really, I'm so glad that we're having this conversation nationally about abortion right now. I think it points out all of these other sort of blind spots in our policy where all of these things are related. We are all in this together. We need to figure out how we can support one another.
Stephanie Ronaday-Kreider is the executive director of Ohio Right to Life. Stephanie, thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Not tired of this song, though. It's a classic. It's your daily dose of kindness now. Of all the stories CBS's Steve Hartman has covered this year, the most shared report was the story of a beloved Dallas school bus driver, Curtis Jenkins. Steve has an update.
As we first reported last May, Curtis Jenkins loves delivering these little ones to Lake Highlands Elementary in Dallas, Texas.
Yes.
Emily Grunninger is the principal.
He goes way beyond the outlined responsibilities and duties of a bus driver. I mean, that bus is like a family.
These are my children. These are my community. I love them all.
To establish community,
what's your job, man?
He starts by giving everyone responsibility.
This is one of the police officers.
It's an elaborate flowchart.
She's an administrative assistant to the president.
Administrative assistant to the president.
Yeah.
Everyone working together to build a yellow bus utopia.
Yeah. And we're going to care about each other and we're going to love everybody, right? I put time, effort, love, care, understanding each and every one of those kids.
Omar.
To show his love and understanding,
hey, Chief.
Curtis gives presents throughout the year.
You say you like baseball.
Each gift personally selected with that child in mind. He gave this girl a T-shirt.
Her first book.
With a picture from a book she made.
I'm hoping this T-shirt inspires her to keep on writing books.
Over the years, he has bought these kids bikes, backpacks, handed out cards on birthdays, and even turkeys at Thanksgiving. He has spent thousands out of his own pocket. And yet, if you ask the kids what they like most about Curtis, the gifts don't even come up.
He helps anyone in need.
Ethan Engel is a sixth grader.
It means a lot to you.
Yeah.
He says the bus ride is often the best part of his day.
My mom got divorced when I was only four.
I'll see you tomorrow.
He's the father that I always wanted. In some ways, I wish my dad could have been like that.
We make the mistake sometimes of thinking certain jobs are more important than others.
I know.
But Curtis Jenkins made his job important. Bye-bye. And in doing so, even created his own salary.
Bye-bye. That's the paycheck right there. If I can get that, you can keep the money.
He sought no reward. But after our story first aired, the kindness came back to him nonetheless when an anonymous viewer reached out to school superintendent Jeannie Stone with a little thank you gift for Curtis.
You're going to be driving this brand new car!
In addition to the car, she also gave him a promotion. Curtis now teaches others how to have better student relationships. For this old bus driver, 2019 sure proved to be quite a ride. Steve Hartman, on the road in Dallas.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.